Wow, you guys got an early start.
Yeah. Come check this out. July 4th, my brother Joseph and myself, in company with several of the brethren, started for home.
Wait, can you give me some context? Is this Brigham, I'm assuming? What's happening here?
Yes, sorry. So this is about Zion's Camp and about the end of Zion's Camp, right? So a group of about 200 men take the journey from Kirtland all the way to the western edge of Missouri. There's probably 25 or so women and children along with them, right?
And that's a group that's going out to Missouri because a lot of the saints are homeless with the persecutions going on out there. So they're bringing money and moral support and whatever they can to aid their brothers and sisters who are out in Missouri.
But ultimately, it disbands. Joseph receives a revelation. So they don't redeem Zion and they have to make the trek back. He says, July 4th, my brother Joseph and myself, in company with several of the brethren, started for home. And we walked all the way, arriving in Kirtland in August, having performed a journey of about 2,000 miles on foot in little over 3 months, averaging 40 miles per day while traveling.
Wow. And with kids in tow.
With kids, women, equipment, right? It's not like, yeah. This is a serious endeavor at a blistering pace.
Literally,
right? I'm sure it was miserable. But this is the part I wanted you to hear. Sometime in the fall of 1834, Dennis Lake, who had been on Zion's Camp, instituted a lawsuit before Justices Dowen and Hansen against Brother Joseph Smith, charging him $30 a month for going up in Zion's Camp to Missouri, alleging that Joseph had promised him a lot of land. I, Brigham, was called up by the attorney for the prosecution, General Payne, and questioned. I was asked if I went up to Missouri with the said camp, and I answered I did. I was asked if I took tools with me. I replied I took a gun, a bayonet, plenty of ammunition, a spade, hoe, and other necessary tools. And I was asked what I was meant to do with my gun and ammunition, and I replied I meant to defend my property, myself and my brethren from thieves and robbers. But then Brigham says he was asked about this whole land thing, right? Specifically, quote, I was asked how much I understood a lot of land to mean. I told them in the burying yard it generally meant 6 feet.
That sounds very Brigham-esque to me. What he's saying is you can't take it with you. That's all you get.
Right. Absolutely. But he continues and he says, Joseph's attorney, Mr. Bissell, hearing me answer these questions and similar questions, punched the prosecuting attorney on the shoulder and asked him if he had any more questions to ask that witness. And he said no.
So I'm guessing Mr. Lake did not win this lawsuit.
He did not. But imagine you've taken this 2,000-mile journey with this group that you have cared for and intimately become acquainted with, and one of them turns around and sues you.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. I'm guessing that Dennis and Lake did not go on to a glorious career in the church. You know, the thing is, Joseph Smith was involved in, it's estimated, about 200 lawsuits during his relatively short adult lifetime. That's pretty amazing. I mean, sometimes he was the defendant, sometimes the witness, sometimes the judge. It's actually been said by some people who've studied his legal record that by the end of his life, he was a pretty good lawyer himself.
He had a lot of apprenticeship hours.
Sure.
He did.
On the job experience. But
yeah.
Did he lose any of those 200?
At the time of his death, he was going to be tried for treason. I doubt that they would have gotten a conviction on that one. But, you know, he was killed before it came to trial. The only other one that I know is his 1826 trial, where he was brought in on charges during the translation of the Book of Mormon of being a glass looker. He was a disorderly person. That was the law term that they used, because he was looking in a seer stone to see things, buried treasure, the Book of Mormon, whatever. But the verdict is unclear. Some say he was acquitted. In any case, we know that he doesn't seem to have sustained a fine or any punishment.
Well, the reason why I bring up this specific legal proceeding is to illustrate, which is what I found fascinating, is that as early as Zion's Camp, Brigham is establishing himself as a defender of Joseph.
Yeah.
Right. Being called to and then gloriously responding to, saying absolutely not.
And it's maybe not insignificant, certainly not coincidental, that shortly after Zion's Camp, he's called to be a member of the original Quorum of the Twelve. And many of those original apostles were veterans of Zion's Camp. It was sort of proving ground.
Right.
But, you know, he's found his role as a defender of Joseph Smith, and he will be that until his own death in 1877.
Exactly. And I got to interview a church historian, Matt Godfrey, who talked to me about Brigham's early time as an apostle and in that formative time.
Oh, fascinating.
Members of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints represent a faith practiced by millions, a faith which has also inspired its share of controversy.
I think if you look at Brigham Young's whole life,
Well, it's a conundrum.
I'm Camry Bagley Fox. And together with John Wilson and Professor Daniel Peterson, we work to uncover unexpected twists in the character of a man that we thought we already knew.
One thing that I wanted to ask about, Matt, is what were Brigham's experiences like as a young apostle? Because we hear the word apostle and we think of a very established, very clearly defined order, but I understand that the early apostleship was not that. Can you tell me about what early apostleship was like? How did these young converts, right, what was it like for them? How did they see themselves and what were their responsibilities? What did being an apostle mean?
So it's interesting because when you think about the apostles, like you were saying, you know, today they're such an important part of the church's organization that sometimes I think we think, well, they were there from the beginning, and they weren't. You know, there's a revelation that Joseph gets in 1829 where he tells Oliver Cowdery and David Whitmer, or the revelation tells them,
to go look, right?
To go look for people who can serve as apostles. And that revelation says that the apostles will be special witnesses of Jesus Christ. And so Oliver later says that after they received this assignment, that their minds were stretched out to try to find the apostles. Mm-hmm. But it's 6 years after that revelation before the apostles are finally called. So it's not until 1835, the church has been organized for 5 years before Joseph Smith feels that it's time to call 12 apostles.
So this is about a year after Zion's camp, give or take.
Yeah, yeah. So it's February of 1835.
Yeah, so even less.
Yeah, even less than a year. And I think one reason why it was finally time to call the apostles was because during the Zion's Camp expedition, Joseph had an opportunity to really get to know a lot of the men in the church, who they were, how they reacted under trying circumstances, kind of what their characters were, what their personalities were. And so in February of 1835, Joseph Young, who is Brigham Young's brother, later kind of looking back on this period, said that after a meeting that was held on a Sunday in Kirtland, Joseph asked Brigham and Joseph Young to come to his house. Now, both Brigham and Joseph Young had great singing voices. They were really good singers. And so Joseph liked to hear them sing. So they came over and Joseph asked them if they would sing. So they did. And then after that, Joseph received like a kind of a vision in his mind. And he said, the time has come for us to call 12 apostles in the church. And he said, and Brigham, you will be one of them. And he told Joseph Young, it's also time that we call the 70 in the church as well. And Joseph, you'll be one of them. And so they designate 12 men as apostles. 8 of those 12 had been on the Zion's Camp expedition. A couple weeks later, they'll call about 56 men to serve as 70. All 56 of those men had been on Zion's Camp. So this really was kind of a training ground in a way for Joseph to really have the Spirit tell him, you know, who was ready for this.
I find the Zion's Camp preparation so interesting because you have these people who are just like trying to survive. They're living on the edge of civilization. They're just trying to scrape out a living. And then they're called to abandon their families and follow Joseph on this 2,000-mile journey. It's crazy.
And it's like we are called to serve in modern day elders' quorums and relief societies, right? We are called occasionally to go far beyond our comfort zone. And the spiritual nature of the work is the same. But in this case, the physical
so much more intense
requirement of this particular ministering visit,
sheer mileage.
It's extreme. Sheer mileage, yeah. Let alone the conditions.
And the mental load that not only are they traveling that far, but they have to be ready to fight, right? They believe that they're going to have to fight when they get there. Dan, do we know if they were like training along the way?
They were. Every few days, they'd pause, they'd camp, they'd do military drills, mock combat, and so on, because they think it's very likely that they're going to encounter armed resistance and that they'll have to fight. There is one funny note. There's a boy named Lyman Littlefield who's going along with the Zion's Camp March. He's only 14. You can imagine, he's having the adventure of his life. I mean, going to battle, that sort of thing. But he's disappointed because the grown-ups won't let him join in the military drills and the mock combat and so on. And so, you know, he, I'm sure, feels like, well, I can do this. I'm a man. But then they say, no, you're not. Nope.
I love that. He's so enthusiastic.
Yeah. That's amazing.
One thing I think is interesting is that in the recountings of this journey, it seems like a lot of people talk more about the spiritual takeaway, right? There was a large time of spiritual growth.
Yeah.
More so than the physical toll.
It's interesting. That's how the Lord seems to do it. I mean, he has said that to him all things are spiritual. I mean, even most physical, mundane of tasks can be done in a way that's spiritual if we have the right attitude.
Absolutely.
That's the most important takeaway from this. They didn't, in fact, have a great military impact on Missouri or the fate of the saints there, but it had a huge spiritual impact on the church and its leadership.
And that's what happens when you choose to follow the prophet, regardless of whether it's move here, do this, do that, right? When we follow the Lord's commands through the prophet, the spiritual blessings we reap are always bounteous. It makes me think of the handcart companies too, right?
Yeah.
In post, the stories they tell aren't about how I suffered. It's almost always
how I grew,
right? Yeah. The price we paid to come to know God.
You see that they're clearly coming to know God here, as a large number of them are called to be apostles after.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's so interesting to like contrast that with the more straightforward path that we maybe see today. We just had Elder Kose and Elder Gilbert, who were just called as apostles. And I'd be curious, we should look up Elder Kose and what his trajectory
to
was.
See.
In comparison to like Brigham and the other apostles that were called at that time. Because now it seems to be more straightforward.
Yeah.
So I'd be curious.
But it's also longer.
Yeah, right. That's true.
So basic information, he was born in 1963. And he's the first apostle ever to be called from France. He served a year in the French Air Force. He earned a master's degree in business.
And then his church service, he was called in 2001 as a stake president, 2007 as an Area 70, and was called to be a General Authority 70 in 2008.
Then the next calling was presiding bishop of the church, which he held from 2015 to 2025. So where are we at math-wise?
Well, the simple math is that he was a general authority for 17 years before he was called to the apostleship.
What did Brigham...
What was his...
Yeah, path? What did he do prior to being called as an apostle?
Not that much. I mean, he hadn't been in the church that long. He had served as a missionary. He essentially called himself.
Mm-hmm, right. He's like, I will be teaching the gospel?
Yeah. But then he's called, and this is probably an indication of his evident leadership ability, that he and Heber C. Kimball, who are almost inseparable from the time of their conversion on throughout their lives in the church, both of them are called to be captains of their companies in Zion's Camp. You know, I think we shouldn't underestimate the spiritual nature of this experience in Zion's Camp. I mean, they are there every day with the prophet Joseph Smith. And Brigham later says, every chance I got, I sat as close to him as possible. I wanted to watch him and hear him, you know, see how he behaved, what he said. Seeing the prophet under all circumstances, not just when he's giving a sermon or he's sitting comfortably propounding a new doctrine, seeing him getting blisters on his feet and walking and under stress, watching how he reacts, and the fact that Brigham comes out of this with this ever stronger testimony of Joseph Smith is interesting, because he said, I was really observant.
Yeah, well, you think about, like, for many people, a mission experience is probably our modern equivalent to a Zion's Camp, where you've spent this concentrated, consecrated, every waking moment kind of effort over 2 years trying to serve the Lord specifically in that way. And I can imagine if you had that type of experience with the prophet as your companion.
Yeah.
That really you would have just been like, oh. But God knows the responsibilities on the kingdom are going to mount quickly, right? What's going to be required. And so it's like, I don't have the time. I don't have 25 years to slowly
ease
you into gospel responsibility. Right. It's going to fall on your shoulders soon, if not now. So how fascinating to see the design of a journey like this to say, this is how I'm going to get it done.
And not just the amount of responsibility they would need, but like actually the specific responsibilities that these church leaders would take on in just a few years, you know, where they would be called to make a much larger trek.
Yeah, think of it. Brigham is and Heber are going to have to help the saints out of Missouri to Illinois. And then this huge thing, still famous in general American history, not just church history, is this enormous migration to the Great Basin. And then beyond that, they had already done it. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure they learned from mistakes and everything else.
Yeah, and the amazing thing is they weren't all that old.
No.
In our next episode...
It's gone. What more proof do I need?
That proves nothing.
It proves everything.
I will not stand here and be accused.
Brothers.
What is happening?
Warren and I were just discussing the loss of some banknotes.
I'm not sure I understand. Brother Parrish, what is he talking about?
Unfounded accusations. He says I've been stealing banknotes.
$20,000!
Perhaps you've been careless.
Careless? Warren was the only one that...
Joseph, I'm sorry! Warren was the only one who had access.
What's going on? What happened?
The bank's gone bust. There's no money.
So what happens is you have people who have invested into the Kirtland Safety Society church members, and when the bank fails, their attitude, some of them, is, well, wait a second. Joseph's supposed to be a prophet. Why didn't he see this coming?
Join us next time. You won't want to miss it.